This is Audible.
Behold, I am soldier bold and only 25 years old. A braver warrior never was seen.
Audible Originals presents Unspoken. Written and read for you by me, Luke Daniels. Prologue. Welcome, listeners. I'm Luke Daniels. I'm an actor and writer, and for the last decade, I've been very, very fortunate to build a successful career in the thriving audiobook industry. I know, reading books all day? The dream job. I first got my start in audiobooks in a professional studio environment. Then I built my own home studio in the suburbs outside of Detroit. Subsequently, over the past decade, I've recorded over 600 titles. It's hard to know the exact number, but I can honestly say that I've averaged at least a book a week for 10 years. I mean, that's a lot of words. Like an epic metric buttload of words, or EMB for brevity's sake. Point is, for me, up until now, words have not been in short supply. However, by and large, this unending tide of words have been someone else's. I seriously don't even talk much in real life. I'm an introvert who likes to observe and mimic. That's my comfort zone. But now, it's time for me to try saying my own words. And, frankly, it terrifies me. Not this part. Sitting in my recording booth, talking to you. After an EMB, or epic metric buttload of words, talking into a microphone is pretty much second nature to me. And I've always had these voices in my head that desperately want a way to come out and be heard. I mean, give me some dialogue between a battle-hardened reptilian cyborg alien who's the last of his race and a sassy space dragon, and I'm all over it. Alien.
Come, Klug. Together we must risk great mortal peril to prevent galactic Armageddon, and at the same time mend the fractious alliance between our two divergent species.
Dragon.
I'm a righteous death dragon, and I will ultimately shock you, and indeed the entire galaxy, as I selflessly sacrifice myself to save you, my alien counterpart, in the end of Book 7. Teen.
Alien.
Alas, this is true, for it was foretold by the Necro-Witch of Alatar. But fret not, my salacious Terragon of Terror. You will continue to be able to commune with me in spirit form for the next 22 books in this series.
Righteous.
But my own personal story, that's a real challenge for me. I'm the narrator and the writer. How exactly does that work? I mean, it all just feels so meta and self-involved. I find myself asking myself, and yes, that happens a lot, I'm one of those inner dialogue people. But in starting this project, I kept asking myself, what gives me the right to tell my story when everyone has one? What makes me so special? Does my story even deserve to be told? And that voice is right. Everyone does have a story to tell, and everyone deserves a chance to tell theirs. And if this is my chance to tell mine, then the real failure would be for me to squander it. By the way, squander is a fantastic word. It sounds exactly as it means. I love words like that. Squander. I never squander a chance to say a good word a second time, so I can really relish it. Ooh, relish. Mustard. Hot dogs? Sorry. But, most importantly, this story is not just mine. It's also my son Finnegan's. It is a story that until now has remained mostly unspoken. And that's not just because I've been too grief-stricken to really talk about it myself, but because Finn never had, nor ever will have, a voice of his own. And so despite doubt, fear of failure, and just plain old laziness, I find myself here, in my home studio, microphone in front of me, an EMB of my own words staring back at me. And I gotta admit, I feel a little exposed. And it's not just because I'm naked right now while I narrate this. JK. Or am I? But all kidding aside, if I'm being completely honest with myself, what I really want is to lean into that vulnerability, to embrace my nakedness, so to speak. I want to offer up my exposure and my pain as a connection to those of you listening, because Finn's is a story that I hope can help people. And I truly believe, in my heart of hearts, that this story deserves to be told, as much as it needs to be heard, as all of our stories do. So, here we go. In 2016, the morning after Valentine's Day, my son passed away from breathing issues complicated by congenital birth defects. He was 21 months old, and his name was Finnegan. That's purposely vague, because honestly, I don't know how to explain all his conditions in any kind of concise, clear way. I can use terms like laryngeal cleft, and bronchial tracheomalacia, and cerebral hypoxia. But the truth is that while I might understand what those conditions are on some very basic layman's level, I can't tell you why he had these issues. Even now, 4 years later, I don't know what ultimately was responsible for his health being so poor that he couldn't make it to 2 years old. But I do know that it was an absolute miracle he even made it that far. What I also know is that he had ginormous, rosy cheeks, soft, wispy, curly, red hair, and the bluest eyes I've ever seen that could change color when he laughed, cried, or was in pain. I know he always had sweaty hands because they were always clenched so tight. I know he could never speak, but he could laugh, choke, and cough. I know that I've never, ever seen someone who suffered like he did. I know that his life has to have meaning, but I don't know what that meaning could possibly be. I know that it wasn't until he was 21 months old that he was finally able to rest. I know, it's heavy stuff. Take a breath with me. And another. And one more. This kind of loss is terrifyingly huge and scary. But I promise you, the love and light in the story far outweigh the tragedy. That's precisely why I need to share it with you. I really want his story to be a way we can try to destigmatize death and grief together. I truly believe grief needs to be talked about. Because we will, all of us, feel its unbreakable grip sooner or later, and the effect of that is so powerful, it can only be tempered by exposure. Grief cannot remain unspoken. Grief is like taking your normal stream of consciousness and turning it up to 11. There's so much feedback and distortion that it's hard to hear the melody, and everyday tasks become almost unbearable. Grief is also an uncontainable and ever-spreading flood. It has no borders or structure. Most days, I feel like the little boy with his thumb in the dam. So, yes, this story may be driven by tragedy, but at its heart is hope. Hope for a way forward, out of darkness. Hope for the betterment of myself and others. Hope that my son's voice can finally be heard. Hope for laughter and joy again. Hope for the future. Hope to feel hope again. But after 4 years dealing with this grief and this loss of hope, what I'm realizing only now is that hope isn't something I can find through outside sources. Any real hope I have of finding real hope comes from within. It comes from facing the worst feelings but not indulging in and succumbing to them. But what do I draw on when the well is dry? When the wet, stinking, clinging wool blanket of grief threatens to smother me and I can't breathe. Just like he couldn't breathe every day, or while he slept, or when he was choking or coughing or in the ambulance, surrounded by kind, worried faces, and the memories all spill together and I spiral into grief, what do I do then? That's when exposing that grief becomes so important. That's why I need to give my grief its own voice. My voice. Through my voice, maybe I can build a structure out of the chaos of my grief. A mansion of grief that I can visit in my mind to honor the loss, but that keeps the grief from spilling over and flooding everything else. Maybe I can transform the grief by accepting its cold touch and then ushering it out into the light. because grief thrives in dark corners where it can latch on and metastasize. Grief armors itself with our pain and sorrow. Grief begets more grief. These are grief bunnies, and unchecked, their population will only multiply because they are horny AF. I often find it helps to visualize my grief through symbolism and metaphor, and strangely humor. So, in that vein, and bear with me here, grief is like the Marvel comic character Eddie Brock and his alien symbiote, Venom. The symbiote latches onto Eddie and wants to consume the world, spreading like cancer. It feeds on the negativity and emotions of its host, and the more the host gives into the darkness, the stronger the symbiote becomes. Venom's biggest weakness is sound. In the comics, Spider-Man, my favorite character, tricks Venom into fighting in an old bell tower. When the bells chime, Spidey's able to defeat the weakened symbiote, separating it from Eddie and saving him. Well, that is until the symbiote finds other hosts, and the rest of his alien buddies come to Earth and try taking over through carnage, and yada, yada, yada. If the symbiote is my grief, threatening to change me into a slavering, homicidal beast bent on destruction and mayhem, then the sound of the bells clanging is me putting voice to my grief, exposing it to the music of the spheres, separating myself from the alien symbiote. So, allow me to toll the bell of my grief. Finnegan Roy Daniels. Born into pain, his every breath tortured, his life cut short. I'm left behind, filled with unanswered questions, desperately seeking peace. It is a constant fight to fill my grief with love, a desperate search to find hope, to not let his suffering be for nothing, to not allow my grief to destroy me. So, now that I've tolled the bell, I will continue my search for redemption. I won't give up trying to get better because he absolutely 100% never gave up. No matter what obstacle was put in his path, he kept going. Unable to hold his own head up, I will hold mine higher for him. So, sorry, Spidey, but Finny is my favorite superhero now. Thank you again for taking this trip with me, for listening to his story. I hope his love will embrace you and guide you as it does me. I hope his story will inspire you to give voice to your own. I hope you can speak your grief with me, and together we can rise above the pain. So, let's begin. Part 1. During Finn. Author's note. I've broken this book up into parts because I immensely dislike saying the word chapter. Do you know how many times I've had to say chapter? Like, think of an epic metric buttload and then, like, multiply it by, like, I don't know, another EMB. Chapter 1, chapter 12, chapter 45, and a third. So, yeah, for this book, no chapters. We do in parts, baby. Part 1. During Finn. Wibbly, wobbly, timey-wimey stuff. May 11th, 2014. February 15th, 2016. August 12th, 2019. 3 dates going back 5 years in time. What do they mean? I can tell you that May 11th, 2014 was a Sunday. It was also Mother's Day. February 15th was a Monday and the day after Valentine's Day. And today is August 12th, a Monday as well. It also happens to be the day I'm writing this. But not the day I record this, and also not the day you listen to this. Time is weird. So what do these dates have in common? A story. For anyone else, these dates are part of their story and might mean nothing to them. But for me, everything. Today, or rather the day I wrote what I'm now reading and you're now listening to, is special because I begin my journey to write Finn's and my story. Mother's Day of 2014 is the day Finnegan was born. And the day after Valentine's Day of 2016 is the day Finnegan died. To me, these dates give structure to that which can't be quantified. They are coat hooks to hang my grief from. Finn's birth, Finn's death, and now Finn's rebirth through story and words. And though they seem random, these particular dates stand in my mind as memorials to suffering, letting go, and rebirth. It's been 1,919 days since he was born, and 1,274 days since he was released from his suffering, or 274 weeks since I met him, and 182 weeks since he passed on. That's 46,056 hours since I had the greatest moment of joy, and 30,576 hours since I began my journey through grief. But today? Today is important as well. Today I'm telling his story. Not just for me, not just for him, but for you, a listener. Someone who has their own dates of joy and grief. You. And today, as I look back at these dates, I feel that the tragedy of Finn's death has split my life story into three distinct parts. There's before Finn, during Finn, and you guessed it, after Finn. And they feel like three completely different lifetimes, or maybe three divergent timelines, but all connected through the same delicate thread that started to weave its way through my life on Mother's Day, May 11th, 2014, the day Finn was born. I'm at the hospital. My son is going to be born. I don't even have a name picked out. I've been up most of the night with my girlfriend waiting for our baby to arrive. Arrive? Like a delicate delivery by a wise stork? Yeah, no. Babies don't so much arrive as they crash land, even in the best of circumstances. However, this is not the best of circumstances. I know something is wrong. A nagging unease in my guts. A feeling of the wah-wahs. I can hear my blood flowing and my heart beating in my ears. It's the feeling I associate with heightened danger and a drastically changing reality. For one, there are way too many doctors, nurses, and techs in the room. Before Finn's birth, I'd been through the birth of my daughter. And while that day was appropriately terrifying, especially as I was a young 22-year-old boy who had no clue what I was in for, this is different. This is chaos and fear. I can feel it pulsing through my veins, and I can see it in the doctor's and nurse's eyes. There's a thickness in the air, a tension in the too many bodies packed into a too small space. There's a feeling in me like I'm a bit outside myself, watching it all rapidly unfold from just over my own shoulder.
Dad. Dad.
What? Your dad, right? Yes. Well, Dad, we're worried that baby may have ingested meconium. His oxygen saturation is concerning, and his heart rate seems to be dropping, so we're going to go ahead and induce, okay? I understood very little of that. Okay, well, Dad, we're going to need you to step out of the way over here, please. When dealing with a sick kid or even a routine procedure, sometimes a healthcare worker refers to the parent as simply Mom or Dad. It makes sense, I guess, as they can't be expected to always know my name or have time in the moment to ask. But it's kind of weird hearing it from a middle-aged stranger in purple Lilo and Stitch scrubs. And even more disorienting in a medical emergency, as it's a stark reminder of my role and what's currently at stake. And so much is at stake. My baby's health and well-being, and my responsibility to him as his father and caretaker. To that end, I feel it's important to acknowledge Finnegan's mother and her story. She and I are no longer together. And out of respect for her, I can only speak about my own perspectives on what we went through. Finnegan's mother loved him and fought for him just as much as anyone, but that's her story to tell. Eventually, inevitably, Finnegan finally crash lands on this world at 10:30 a.m. the next morning. But immediately upon delivery, he isn't breathing. The nurses hurry him over to a table for suctioning. There's no offer for me to cut the cord or for him to be held. There's no time. In that moment, things both speed up and slow down. Certain details stand out, but my immediate comprehension is lagging while a bubbling, growing fear is lurking in my gut. I feel an awful, impotent ability to contribute anything of value to the situation. All I can do is watch. New pink skin. starting to shade blue. And listen. Unraised but firm and urgent voices giving instructions. Machines beeping and tubes making a horrible suction sound as they try to clear his lungs. There are now more nurses in yet different colored scrubs. Doctors in white who stand and mutter and sweat. I hear them say they may have to intubate him if he can't breathe on his own. I stand. I watch. I don't breathe either. I try to see him. Thankfully, I'm tall and I can see over the bent necks of the nurses as they continue to suction. He still looks blue. I try to relay what I'm seeing to his mom in the bed. I try to listen to the doctors and nurses and parse some meaning from their words. Unfortunately, it's all happening too fast to understand. Eventually, hours, minutes, who knows how long, time is weird. But eventually, these wizards of nursing suction enough gunk out of him that my son starts breathing on his own. Though with a disconcerting rattle in his small chest that hints at problems still to come. To my surprise, he's not taken to NICU. I'm surprised because it was NICU nurses who arrived to suction him. But they are off again, no doubt to save more lives. And everyone left in the room is a little stunned and a lot quiet as baby is cleaned and wrapped and eyed nervously and cautiously. Now that the immediate danger has been mitigated, the hospital professionals assure me that he's fine now, and that yes, they can hear his rattly breathing, and yes, that means he still has junk in his lungs, and yes, they will continue to come back and suction and monitor, and yes, that can be dangerous if it should become infected, but yes, really, they think he should be fine. Especially once he coughs up all that yucky, ucky crud. And now, here's your baby. At this point, Dredd takes a back seat to the immediate necessary functions of having a newborn. Clean him, hold him, get some skin-to-skin time. Talk to him, smell him. Try feeding, try sleeping, try breathing. Try again. But the panic is still there, simmering under the surface. His breathing does not sound good. His coloring is off. Shouldn't he be more awake? More alert? Or am I overreacting? Listen to the doctors and nurses. They don't seem openly concerned. Openly being the operative word there, bucko. I can see it in their eyes, in their posture. They are watching and waiting too. They don't know either. Practicing medicine is just that, practicing. So much of it is guesswork. And yes, just waiting and watching and listening. Listen to the deep rattle as he breathes in and out. He hasn't cried yet, has he? Is that normal? All babies are different, they say. There is no normal. Then why do I have this feeling he needs something? Someone to step in and say, aha, you are correct, sir. I shall now clearly explain why your paternal protective instinct is cranked up to 11. But no one says that. And instead, now they need to take him for some type of scanning or weighing or x-ray. Do we have a name yet? A name? Yes, a name for baby. Oh, yes, of course. No, not yet. Is that normal? Should we have settled on that already? It's fine. Remember, there is no normal, Dad. But what about that rattling sound? Don't worry. The doctors are monitoring it. In the meantime, we have just a couple more invasive tests, and now there seems to be something wrong with his eyes. Wait, what? His eyes? What about his eyes? Probably nothing. Might, possibly could be this one thing that has a really long name you won't remember, and it has something to do with red light reflections and lasers. No, wait, that's not right. That doesn't matter, because I can't remember, and I didn't ask the nurse to explain it further. But still, more tests. And meanwhile, he isn't eating. And there's still that constant rattle, and he still coughs up goop. Does that mean he might still have meconium in his lungs? Could it be infected? Should he be suctioned more? Or is that doing more harm than good? He struggles to cough up what's there. It's like his throat doesn't work right. So the crud just sits there and rattles with every breath. Always that rattle. Everyone shares genuine concern, but no one knows what to do. but they do know his test results came back from that one test with the long name you don't remember and the lasers and the red light reflection, and actually, it turns out nothing's wrong with his eyes. That's good news, right? And I'm sure you're dying to take home little... Wait, do you have a name for this little guy yet? A name? No, I mean, yes, but... I mean, do we need to do that right now? It's just that he's got that rattly breathing, and I'm worried about him, and I need to pay attention to him in case he needs me to pound on his back if he starts choking. And is that even okay? I'm just trying to help him get out whatever's rattling around in there. Oh, yes, Dan. In fact, that's called percussing, and a lot of our little warriors need that done several times a day. And here, take this soft rubber mallet called a percussor, and that will really create some movement to help get out that icky crud. And anyway, while you do that, can we also have you fill out an EMB of forms and paperwork? And lastly, I sure hate to be a pill, Dad, but baby really needs a name. A name? A name. Who has time for a name? It's okay, sir. We can see you're upset, and we can come back. There was so much stimulus, so much input, that time became a blur those first 48 hours of Finn's life. But a hospital system is a living, breathing organism. And just as it takes in those in need, it has to expel those whose needs are deemed not immediate. Well, great news, Dad. Looks like this little guy's cleared to go home. Wait, what? Really? Yep, all set. But what about that rattly breathing? If you're still worried about it, you can always take him into his pediatrician. Do you have a pediatrician for him yet? Well, yes. We're here now. That's true. But now you have to leave. But we don't even have a name for him. Now he's coughing again, so let me get a cloth and his percussor. Damn it, where is it? Don't you hear him? He's choking on his own crud. Plus he's barely eating, and he's sleeping all day and night, and his color looks off. Sleeping is normal for a newborn. I thought you said there was no normal. Sir, please don't get upset. I am upset, and I... No. No, he's not ready. I'm not ready. We're staying. Well, okay. If you're that concerned, the attending says you can stay. But only for one more day. And in the meantime, we'll need his name. Finnegan. His name is Finnegan. Finnegan Roy Daniels. May 11th, 2014 was the start of a 21-month marathon that would leave me utterly broken. Physically, mentally, emotionally, morally, financially. As time moved forward from the date of Finn's birth, my initial nagging inkling of dread became fully realized, as each new day brought trips to his pediatrician and eventually the hospital in response to his increasing pain and suffering and endless unanswered questions. The domino effect had begun. First, it was concern for his lungs. Then from out of left field, a brief scare with his eyes onto massive and long-lasting stomach and feeding issues. Each day, toppling the next domino and the next. Each worry and disaster happening sometimes concurrently, sometimes apart. Until we found ourselves back where we'd started with his lungs, which in a surprise reversal led to the discovery that it had always been his throat and airways that were the biggest issue. But... by then it was too late, because months later, the final domino would fall and the extensive and irreversible damage to his brain would be revealed. From the scans, I could actually see the trauma of each day's falling domino mapped onto his once perfect brain. This trauma of time, this inescapable prison of circumstance, swallowed up my son whole until there was nothing left. But during that time, during those 21 months, we fought. He fought. Every day and every night was a battle against those dominoes. Because what else could we do? When disaster finds us, there is no choice. You keep going. That's what Finn did. So, that's what I do.
Finterlude. May 2016. After Finn. Bear with me, hardy listeners. I'm going to use these sections to jump us around a little in time, so we can take a break from the intensity of Finn's life, and also so we can learn about his before and after. So, hop in my Bill and Ted's phone booth, time machine, vocal booth, and we'll travel to just a few months after Finn's death, when I was probably at my lowest. I get cold easily. Always have. Bad circulation, probably. My years of being a smoker don't help. I know, I'm a voice actor. What in the name of self-destruction am I thinking? However, neither does it help living in Michigan. It's really cold here. But it's not just cold, it's perpetually gray. Overcast, they call it. The local news actually has an official gloom and doom counter during the winter months that keeps track of how many days we've gone without sun. We Michiganders are obsessed with weather. And for me as an audiobook narrator, any local news broadcast is a treasure trove of unique voices and characters to listen to. News anchor.
Oh my goodness graciousness. Thanks for that report, Lorraine. 57 days without any sun. I think that's a new record. Ha! Now it's over to Stephen in WKPZYW Snowmobile Mobile Weather Center. Hey, Stephen, are you with us? Stephen.
Yeah. Hi, Roger. I'm here at Kalkuska's annual Winter Ice Parade and Pasty Eating Contest. And let me tell you, the absolute bitter winds and sub-zero temperatures are not stopping this year's crowds. In fact, this year looks to be the biggest yet. There are about 7 people here now. And I even saw that there's going to be a Ronald McDonald magic show after the parade under the Pulaski County Park Open Air Pavilion. So, pack up the kiddos and join us down here. Maybe bring some blankets and foot warmers and finger warmers and an appropriate underlayer. And, you know, maybe some black decaf coffee and a thermos that's never been properly cleaned and that your grandfather used to hide his whiskey in. In fact, bring whiskey. Bring all the whiskey. Roger.
Thank you, Stephen. That was very specific. Are you feeling okay?
I feel nothing.
Well, you stay warm, Steve. Oh, and before I let you get back to slowly freezing to death, can you give us the forecast?
The forecast? You want to know the forecast?
If it's not too much trouble, Stephen.
Sure, Roger. I'll give you the forecast. You ready? Overcast! It's gonna be overcast and cold and generally unfucking pleasant. There's your forecast. It's day 57 without sun on our oh-so-jolly daily gloom meter. So if you really want the forecast, Raj, put your pants on. Get your fat ass out from behind that fucking desk and look out the ever-loving window. There's your forecast. More of the fucking same misery. I quit.
I digress, but you get the point. Michigan is cold. You know what else is cold? Jail. Jail is really damn cold. Jail in Michigan. Two cold places I have no earthly desire to be in. And yet, I find myself slowly swimming back to consciousness in a cold Michigan jail cell early one gray morning of 2016. Don't get me wrong, I deserve to be there. I am the bad guy in this. Just a very pathetic bad guy, whose only dramatic foils are my own grief and bad decisions. As reality finds me and I come to, my head hurts, my ribs hurt, my stomach is in tatters, and I stink. I mean, don't get me wrong, jail has its own unique funk too, but I smell like vomit and alcohol sautéed in a roux of fear sweat. I'm also by myself on a bench in a small cell with plexiglass or whatever windows. As I start to come back to life, I realize I'm in the fetal position and the bench I'm on is cold, oh so cold, concrete. I want to sit up, but I fear my head will actually fall off if I do. Shivering, with my arms wrapped around myself, I realize I have short sleeves on. No wonder I'm so cold. But, wait, hang on a minute, the short sleeves are on a shirt that seems to be attached to the pants? But that would mean I'm in a jumpsuit. Hold on. Let's start over. I'm on a cold slab behind plexiglass, and I'm in a jumpsuit. Oh my
God, am I dead? In a morgue? But if I were dead, why would I still feel so epically hungover? I feel shitty, therefore I am, right? So if I'm not dead and I'm not in a morgue, then I must be alive after making some very, very poor choices. Oh, shit. I'm in jail. What? How? What happened? And what in the name of the patron saint of regrets happened to my clothes? What disaster could have befallen me that I would need my clothes taken and replaced with an orange jumpsuit? I honestly don't remember. Oh my God. Did someone have to change me? Like some 36-year-old blacked-out drunk baby? Dear God, what have I done? Sitting up was hard, opening my eyes harder, not just because of the whiskey weights that pulled them down, but because I finally knew where I was. And now I also knew what I had done. I knew I had to face it, too, this harsh reality I had chosen through my selfish, careless, and supremely dangerous actions. But I didn't want to. So I cried. Some bad guy. And these weren't like, oh man, what happened? Oh no, oh man, tears. No siree. I'm talking like, oh man, what happened? Oh man. Gulping air and gagging and gurgling and much gnashing of teeth. I love that expression. So evocative and so accurate to this situation. Who knows how long that lasted? Jails are like casinos in that once you're in them, there's zero concept of time. Well, that and both are depressing AF. But however long my wailing lasted, I did eventually sputter out. Again, you know what I mean, rocking back and forth with that raggedy, wheezy aftercry breathing. I tried remembering more about the events of the last evening and realized I couldn't. Not really, just flashes without any context. I remembered standing behind my car with the trunk open, weeping as I showed a police officer sympathy cards for the passing of my son, a desperate and foolish plea for mercy. I also remembered popcorn. Whatever fine establishment I'd visited had popcorn, and I must have eaten a lot of it, because I remember the taste and smell of popcorn, but not the good kind, the smell and taste of it being thrown up. It was a consistency and texture that, stuck in my mind. And I remembered a very sudden and crushing impact, something unexpected, hard and violent, a flash of reflected headlight and a rush of energy coming to a sudden standstill. And that was basically it. More would come, but in those first moments, that was all I could parse in my whiskey-sodden state. So I did what anyone would do. I started crying again. Thankfully, this time was shorter-lived and morphed into me actually making it to fully standing and even staggering over to peer out the plexiglass window of my new domain. There was a larger cell to my right and across from me the guard station. There, behind more glass, like stacked Tupperware, were two officers. Without really thinking about it, my focus latched onto the two guards, and I tried to get their attention. By that I mean I continued to weep and whine and look pitiful. Surely they would see my honest distress and take pity on me. I didn't belong there. I'm a good guy.
Oh, really?
Who said that?
Me.
Me who?
Precisely.
What?
Me who? That's me.
Who?
Precisely.
Oh my God. What do you want?
To remind you that you've done nothing wrong. Sure, yeah, maybe you made a mistake and drove drunk, but jail? Really? You're just a grieving father. It's not fair. This is all just a big misunderstanding because you are actually a good guy, and good guys don't go to jail.
Wait. I see what you're doing. This is like some reverse psychology, right? Are you trying to trick me?
Who, me?
Yes, you.
Me? Who?
Clearly, I was still quite drunk. Eventually, one of the guards relented to my pleading and sniveling and made brief eye contact. Whereupon, without any prior planning, I immediately started saying,
"Phone call! I get a phone call! I mean, I didn't get a phone call, but I'm supposed to get a phone call. Not like get one like, 'Hey, Luke, you got a phone call,' but like I get to make a phone call, don't I? Please?"
Unsurprisingly, by this time, I no longer had the guard's eye contact. And also, unsurprisingly, my Clarence Darrow-like argument failed to secure me a phone call. Eventually, though, a guard did come over. But alas, it quickly became apparent that there was not going to be some deus ex machina rescue, no easy escape. I'd proved my inability to make good choices, so now my choices have been taken away from me. And for good reason. Clearly I was in the wrong and had to answer for what I'd done. This was the reality I had created for myself. For now, all I could do was hurry up and wait for whatever would come next. That eventually turned out to be my phone call. I was also given a little more info about what had happened the previous night, along with a bologna sandwich, which was disgusting, but thoughtful, actually. Apparently, around 3 or 4 in the morning, I had driven into a ditch about a quarter mile from my home. No deer, no other cars involved, thank God. I must have simply blacked out while driving, like an idiot. One of the guards then informed me that I was in the jumpsuit because I had so thoroughly soiled my clothes. They actually washed them for me and gave them back when I was released. That was strange, but also thoughtful. I still have the shoes I was wearing. I call them my prison shoes, and I don't like to wear them anymore, so I let my dog chew them. The shoes are a gray suede slip-on loafer, the kind of boating shoe that's made for cocktails at the marina. And paired with my new orange jumpsuit, as well as my general sniveling, shaking, stinking aura, I must have been quite a sight. And smell. And sound. Just all the senses would have been on total red alert seeing me shuffling through the booking process. But here was the real info I wanted. When would I be getting out of there?
Guard. "Well, you gotta blow zeros, then we can release you."
Me. What does that mean?
"It means you can go home."
No, I know what release means.
Be weird if you didn't. I meant, what do you mean by...
By what?
By that other thing you just said. When?
Just now.
"You blow zeros, we can release you."
Yes, that. Blow zeros. What does that mean?
I told you, kid, it means you can go home.
I understand that, but how?
Jesus, kid. I don't know. The bus?
By then, the guard had moved on and wouldn't come back until later. However, he had now moved me to a larger cell with a handful of other men in it. It was there that I learned I wouldn't be released until my blood alcohol was at 0%, meaning that when I blew into a breathalyzer, it would read 0. Hence, blowing zeros. Now, I know all of you understood that right away, but you have to keep in mind my mind, specifically the mush my mind was currently mired in. But eventually I figured it out. And the next time I could catch the guard's eye, I said,
"Officer, please, officer, I think I'm ready. Can I try to blow zeros?"
"Yeah, right. You ain't gonna blow zeros yet."
"How do you know? Just let me try, please."
The guard seemed to take pity on me, because he agreed to let me blow into a breathalyzer.
"All right, blow into this, but make sure your lips are sealed when you blow out."
Although I might have been unused to it then, blowing into a plastic tube would become my new daily reality for the next 6 months. And as I awkwardly leaned forward and wrapped my dry lips around the tube, I said a prayer I would come to repeat over and over in those coming months. Internally, I prayed,
"Oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please."
Externally, the guard said,
"Let's see now."
Me, internally,
"Oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please.
Hang on, let me get my readers on."
Me, internally,
"Oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please."
Well, now that's just as I thought. Yes, sirree, Bob. No zeros, see?
Not since grade school math had decimal points stymied me so. Only thing to do, hurry up and wait. Wait and maybe try to puke. Boy, I'll tell you folks, you don't know low until you're jamming filthy fingers down your throat trying to make yourself dry retch into a cold, filthy jail toilet. It didn't help, except to exacerbate my headache and deepen my shame. And eventually I gave in and did what I needed to do. I waited. I sat in my shame and humiliation, and I waited to make amends, to move forward. Eventually, after I'd waited, purged, sweat, shivered, and sworn, cried some more, waited and watched some more, closed my eyes to it all and waited some more, I finally blew them zeros and was released. Which led to more tears, several scalding showers, and finally a fitful, nightmare-filled sleep, followed by pain and soreness from the actual accident. And interspersed with all that, I tried to think, to make a plan for how I could pick up the pieces of my life, if that was even an option anymore. Maybe it was too late for me. I guessed I would just have to hurry up and wait to find out.
Part 2. Summer 2014. During Finn. Being released from the hospital with a newborn is a strange feeling. After the whirlwind of the delivery and all the various post-delivery procedures, after all the checkups and check-ins, eventually, they're like, here's your baby. You don't gotta go home, but you can't stay here. And you find yourself in a hospital, parking garage, structure thing, trying to correctly belt in a 4400 series baby seat, complete with cup holders and battery-powered jungle animal mobile. It can be stressful. More so when the baby has had a traumatic birth and there are still questions about their health. This was a feeling I would get to know well in the months after Finn's birth. Strapping him into his car seat, in the pediatrician's parking lot, or the local hospital's parking garage, or the hour away from town specialist's office, while at the same time trying to keep him warm, or help him cough, or keep him connected to some tubes which need to stay connected to some machine, and saying to myself, I'm scared to take him home. I still don't have any answers. The doc didn't seem to know how to help. This isn't getting better, it's just getting worse. I'm just going to be back here tomorrow. Should I take him somewhere else? Should I admit him to the hospital? Is it all in my head? Am I missing something? Where'd I put his percussor? Oh shit, I just dropped Patches, a stuffed dog in the slush. Crap. I know I'm not the only parent familiar with these feelings. There's so many parents out there who are fighting on the front lines for their kids' health, and it is an exhausting and thankless job. Parents of special needs and chronically ill children are heroes. There's nothing scarier than watching your child suffer. The sleepless nights, navigating complex hospital systems, fighting insurance companies, advocating for what you believe is best for your child, trusting your parental instincts and staying firm when questioned, questioning yourself and trying to see the forest for the trees. These people are honest to God, in the flesh, living and breathing superheroes. When Finn was sick, I quickly realized how many people choose to fight that fight for their children every single day, for years and years and years. And I'm honored to have been a part of this elite club of super parents, if only for 21 months. I also quickly learned, sadly, just how many of these heroes don't get anywhere near the support they deserve. And I get it, out of sight, out of mind. But we shouldn't shy away from engaging and helping those who need it the most. If you want to see true strength, if you want to witness epic freaking fortitude, then talk to the parent of a special needs child. More should be said about these brave people who fight in the trenches every day. It's so easy to avoid what's difficult or scary, and sickness is scary, and death is terrifying. And before Finn, these topics had always felt taboo, and I tried to avoid them. But, like it or not, they're a part of life and unavoidable. The first month at home with Finn was a waiting game, waiting to see if he would wake up to feed, waiting to see if he would fall asleep while feeding or choke on his formula, waiting for the doctor to call back, waiting in a waiting room so we could wait in a different room where we could then wait for the doctor to appear like a medical genie from a nebulizer lamp who can't be kept waiting. During the summer of 2014 and in those first months of Finn's life, despite my inner voice that said, "He is sick. Your son needs help. Do something." I didn't want to believe how sick he was. I couldn't believe how sick he was. I outwardly lived in a state of taking care of the problem at hand. And there were plenty of immediate problems to take my attention, to keep me moving from managing one crisis to the next. I had to. Each day brought different trials, and it was a constant fight just to stay abreast of his issues, let alone get in front of them. But inwardly, I was rattling the cage, shouting that things were not right and going to get worse, that my worst fears would be confirmed and my son wouldn't make it, and that it would be my fault. I was his dad. How could I let something like this happen? If I could only figure it out, get ahead of his issues, find the right specialist who would know what to do. But try as I might, that was not to be. His weekly weigh-ins at the doctor were Godzilla-level stressors. He was never able to make their recommended gains. I remember he just couldn't get past the 12-pound hurdle, no matter what we tried. The docs and nurses would scratch their heads and express their concern with watered-down phrases like, "That's troubling." This often was coupled with an assessing eye turned to us, his parents, as if to parse out our involvement in Finn's emaciated state. By his third month, the dominant issue had shifted from Finn's constant rattly breathing and constant sleeping to his inability to feed in a substantive manner. Eventually, inevitably, inexorably, this all led to his pediatrician giving Finn a failure to thrive diagnosis. I'm sorry, but that's like looking at Chernobyl and saying it done blowed up. Yeah, no shit, Sherlock. But why? That, it seemed, no one could answer. But I kept asking, why am I having to wake Finn up to feed? When he does feed, why does it sound like he's choking on it? Why does he spit up so much? Why are his muscles so limp? Even harder to understand was that he looked perfect. He was beautiful. He was born a healthy and substantial 8 pounds. There were no glaring defects. And initially, at least, he showed positive cognitive development. Whatever was at the root of his issues was on the inside and invisible to us. Or else we weren't looking in the right places. The fall months leading up to Finn turning 6 months old were filled with counting. We counted pounds gained and pounds lost, millimeters of formula swallowed minus millimeters spit up, which was a guesstimate at best for obvious reasons. We tried new types of formula and learned different feeding techniques, all while searching for answers through a smorgasbord of different specialists. Finn's first 6 months were drowned in questions and second-guessing. Maybe it's not his lungs. Maybe it's his stomach. Let's go see a gastro doc. While you're doing that, he really should have his throat checked out. How about a trip to an ENT specialist? They'll just stick some itty-bitty cameras down his throat. What's that? He coughs and chokes when things are placed down his throat. He'll be fine. Oh, he actually choked and coded on the table. Well, we probably should avoid putting things down his throat then. Actually, now that we're here and taking a real good listen, his lungs sound bad. Have we tried taking baby to a pulmonologist? Yes, he has one of those. Oh, that's good. Because I bet this is a lung issue. Or maybe it's his stomach. How about a gastro specialist? And no, don't tell anyone I said this, but I also hear there are some interesting holistic treatments available. Have you thought of that? Witchcraft? Sorcery? Perhaps a blood sacrifice? Round and round we went. Meanwhile, all these visits meant more and more tests and countless pokes with sharps, and exposing Finn to different doctors' offices and hospitals, just a cornucopia of suck. But Finn, the warrior, endured it all. He took on a torturer's wet dream of invasive procedures during his short time with us. Medical tests are bad enough, but when the baby is actively sick, it seems even more cruel. And it made me really start to question how much is too much. Am I simply adding to his issues? When does seeking a cure become more harmful than helpful? I could tell his mind was still sharp and he was very aware. When he was awake, I could see a person in there. I could look into his eyes, and he looked back into mine, and there was a connection there and understanding. He couldn't speak, but when I looked into his eyes, I heard him anyway. Why is this happening? I don't know, buddy. But I'm here. I'm here. And I take his fist and loosen his fingers so they could wrap around mine, and I tried to give him what little comfort I could. I tried to balance his pain and suffering with love and good experiences. I tried. I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't been working from home. It's because of my career in audiobooks that I was able to be there for him as much as I was. It wasn't easy to find much quiet time to record, and I was shown great patience and kindness by publishers, authors, and producers who allowed me leeway on my deadlines during that time. But with Finn's mounting health issues, I had to keep working as much as I could. There were always surprise expenses and never enough money or time or energy to keep up with everything. I needed someone to be with him so I could go into the booth and try to focus enough to tell my stories. Finn's mother took several leaves of absences from her job, but Finn was on her insurance, and it was imperative that we not lose that, so she had to keep working too. Obviously, we couldn't take him to daycare because he was too sick. And the same was true when we tried to find him a nanny. Finn had several kind people who tried to be that for him, but eventually every one of them had to quit because they couldn't handle his issues. What he needed was an in-home nurse, but we quickly found out there were very limited services in the area. We became detectives in a way, trying to track down someone who could help not just with Finn's overall health and well-being, but to help us care for him at home. But for now, it seemed we were on our own. There were infrequent lulls in the trauma drama. A week would go by, and he'd try some new specialized formula, and he'd actually be able to keep it down. Then he'd put on a pound and start to engage more, stay awake for longer periods, play with the toys, and maybe even start to lift his head more and gurgle out a laugh, with his eyes blue and shining, and chubby cheeks flushed and lifted in a smile. But sure enough, the bad days would come again, often in the form of a choking episode brought about by post-feeding spit-up. Those choking episodes were terrifying, as they could end in a big glob of hacked-up baby crud, or an ambulance trip to the hospital. At times, it almost seemed like he would just lock up and stop breathing midway through a coughing episode, as if it were some internal, misguided self-defense mechanism to shut down the coughing and choking. Other times it seemed like his airways got stuck or couldn't open enough to let air or liquids through. Whenever I could slip off to my basement studio to work, I had to listen for the pounding on the floor that signaled, "Finn is choking. Get up here now." God help me if a pan were accidentally dropped and I'd tear out of the booth and leap up the stairs only to a false alarm. But next time, it most likely wouldn't be. It was very hard to focus on a performance when I was always in such a raw state of fearful anticipation. Over time, I became more and more jumpy, more and more frazzled. Maintaining a constant state of alert was debilitating. My nerves were frayed and my mind scattered. One of the stranger side effects was a morbid sense of humor. It seemed only right that if he and I had to go through all this turmoil, at least I could poke fun at it. I need humor. I always have. It takes the seriousness of life and lightens it up a little. So I called Finn the Trickster, or my little Cocopelli. He was Dennis the Menace, but Dennis the Menace written by Shakespeare. What's my baby Loki got up his sleeve today? Just when I would think I was getting a handle on the feedings or the sleep schedule, he'd decide to change it up and catch a cold or become constipated and dehydrated or start choking again. As anyone who has cared for a sick person knows, nights are often the worst. Not much sleep was happening for anyone. We tried humidifiers and propping up his crib mattress, but nothing worked. He just couldn't sleep because of that perpetual coughing and choking. And sleep was not on the agenda for me as I lay awake, listening to the monitor. We're standing over his crib, or holding him, percussing him, crying with him, praying for him, over and over and over, day in and day out. One disaster bleeding into the next. Or, in the words of my plain-speaking, suffer-no-fools grandmother, if it's not one goddamn thing, it's another. Finterlude. Thanksgiving. The late 80s, before Finn. My paternal grandmother, Elizabeth, had a morbid sense of humor of her own and lived by a philosophy to be prepared for shit to happen consistently and frequently in life. She gleaned this life lesson from her own trauma and passed it down to her grandchildren to try to prepare us for the worst that she assumed would inevitably happen. And I was never more grateful for the grit I inherited from her than during the 21 months we spent fighting for Finn. Frankly, as a kid, she terrified me. But now I wish I'd taken the time to get to know her better. Stern and sharp-tongued as she could be, I remember she always had coloring books waiting for me and my brothers when we would visit her in Kansas City, as well as newspaper clippings decorating her walls about my dad's various acting accomplishments. But before she was my grandmother, she was a little girl. As the family lore goes, one day Elizabeth came home from school to find that her father had taken all of her books out to the front yard and set them ablaze. She loved to read, and I suspect his intention was to crush her spark, to take from her what he felt was missing from himself. I imagine her standing in the yard, watching as the flames turn the pages to ash, and my heart breaks for her. I honestly don't know what could drive someone to do that, but it became part of her story and was passed down to me, so now it becomes part of my story too. However, she survived her trauma and went on to marry my grandfather Charles and have a family of her own that she loved and was proud of. I want to do the same, because even though Finn is gone now, that trauma is still alive and well. As time goes by, it gets less sharp, but it's still there, waiting under the surface to rear its ugly head whenever something triggers me. As anyone who's been through trauma knows, once it's triggered, you're right back in that original moment, feeling all those same feelings with just as much intensity. It's exhausting and demoralizing, and it can be seductive to get lost in my memories, to replay those traumatic events over and over until they become this heavy, beat-up suitcase I drag into every room with me. It's a paradox of wanting to remember the good but getting stuck with the bad too, because I don't get to choose which memories stay with me. So I practice remembering the good things, the positive memories that don't make me feel heavy with regret. Things like family Thanksgiving at my grandparents. Even though I saw them so infrequently and only when I was very young, I still have such strong memories of them 30 years later. I can remember that their house smelled different than mine, and I can also remember how that smell did not appeal to me at all. Yes, let's get it out there. I was a very sensitive child. I didn't want to use their silverware either, because I thought it was dirty and I might catch something from them. I don't know what. Oldness, maybe? In reality, their house didn't smell bad and was very clean, but it was different from mine, and so I was afraid of it. Now, before I go on, you should know that in addition to being a sensitive child, I have what polite society calls a weak stomach. Food and I have always had an iffy relationship. A lot like my cocopelli, Mr. Finn. His stomach was very much a shit show too. Pun very much intended. When I was 8, my family and I packed up our car and traveled 2 days to visit Grandmom and Granddad in Kansas City for Thanksgiving. And upon our arrival, we learned, much to our horror, that Grandmom had been so anxious about making us dinner that she'd made it, Wait for it. A week in advance of our arrival. I can still remember eavesdropping on her and my dad in the kitchen, which wasn't hard as my grandmom's voice was the kind that could be heard three states and several mountain ranges away. Thanks for the pipes, Grandmom. Dad. Wait. What, Mom? Grandmom.
I said I was so worried about having a nice meal for you all that I made it all on Thursday. Mom, it is Thursday. I know what goddamn day it is, thank you very much. It's Thanksgiving. Do you mean you made all this last Thursday? That's what I said. Honestly, Jim, you can be a little slow sometimes.
In my grandmom's excitement and subsequent anxiety over our arrival, and also most likely an acute fear of disappointing us, she had prepared the meal in advance, like way, way in advance. At this point, I took it upon myself to inform my brothers that we should under no circumstances eat the food, which was moot for me as I wouldn't be using the silverware anyway. Because of my aforementioned weak stomach, I've always been weird about what I will and won't eat. And not in a good way, like I'll only eat nuts and whey and partake of no delicious bacon or triglycerides. More like, foods that are white make my tummy happy. Like eggies and Wonder Bread and yogurt, but not milk. No, never milk, precious. As a result, I mastered the art of making it look like I'd eaten more than I had at a very young age. I was a fan especially of the mush it all together, then spread it back out randomly to give the plate a picked over look technique. But that strategy can only get one so far in the parental misdirection department, so I eventually had to up my game. To my incredible fortune, my family's kitchen table was a big old wooden spool cut in half. The round center was hollow, and the flat top had convenient holes that led into the hollow section, thereby allowing me to practice my sleight-of-hand skills by distracting my parents and dumping whatever offending item was on that day's menu into the black hole. That is, until one night, when my shameful acts were discovered by the bumbling brilliance of Detective Dad.
Mom?
Yes, honey?
Can I be done?
Oh, honey, you still have all your broccoli and hot dog to finish. What was that?
I said, okay, Mom.
Good boy.
Mom?
Yes, honey?
Got some water?
Yes, honey. She got up from the table and swoop alakazam, them dogs and trees were down the hole and out of my life forever. Or at least until a few months had gone by, and one of the slats from the table's hollow base came loose, prompting my well-intentioned dad to stumble upon the evidence of my heinous and wasteful act.
Hey, Pat. This slat in the table's come loose. I just bumped it with my knee and now it's loose.
Oh no, why'd you do that? I love this. My mother's knee-jerk response to any accidents and small mishaps has always been, why'd you do that?
Well, no, I didn't do it on purpose, honey.
Can you fix it? Dad was now on his hands and knees underneath the table, thoroughly inspecting the problem area. Meanwhile, I was slowly backing out of the kitchen.
Well, I think so, but I'll have to take it out first, and then, well, I might as well clean out the inside. I can't really tell, but well, it looks like there's some junk down here. Hold on, let me just... What the hell is this?
What is it, Jim?
Well, it looks like... Yeah, it's a hot dog, Pat. Pretty dang dried up by the looks of it, too. And that... Is that... Yeah, there's broccoli down here, too. What in the hell is that all about?
Lucas Justin Daniels. Cue, it wasn't me, by the timeless Shaggy, as both sets of parental eyes land on my face. Busted. Again. I don't have a great track record of getting away with my shenanigans. However, I did have my moments, and during that Thanksgiving at Grandmom's, I was intent on pulling off my greatest disappearing food act ever. So cut to my family sitting around Grandmom's dinner table for Thanksgiving. She clearly put a lot of effort into making this meal. It's just unfortunate that it had been a week ago. Sidebar, to this day, my mother swears that it was 2 to 3 weeks old. But no one remembers for sure, so we'll give Grandmom the benefit of the doubt and call it a week.
Because we were at my grandparents', I was away from my trusty kitchen table food dehydrator, and I was forced to employ the mush-it-all-around technique. Unfortunately for me, my grandmother was nobody's fool.
Lucas!
Yes, Grandmum?
You're not eating. No, Grandmum. I mean, yes, Grandmum, I am. See, I ate some here. Balderdash, you just moved it around on your plate.
Oh. Well, I spit it out. I just have a stomach ache, probably from all that driving we did to get here, and I don't feel well.
Well, we'll just say so then. Speak plainly.
Okay. Yeah, my stomach's upset. But I'm sure I'll be fine. But I sure wish I could eat. Looks so good.
At this point, both my brothers were staring daggers at me. My mom was already trying to take care of me. My dad was eating while complimenting my grandmom's cooking. And Granddad was silent, head down, just doing the work of getting his food down. Now, I need to take a moment to discuss what was for dessert. Thank the gods, I had already latched onto the stomach ailment and it saved me from being served any. But in front of everyone else at the table was placed a bowl of Grandmom's now infamous week-old tapioca. Okay, can we just discuss tapioca for a moment? What in the name of June Cleaver is that shit? And why? The textures are just wrong. For me, anyway. Now, I wasn't the only devious Daniels at the table that night. Oh no, the trickster gene is dominant in the Daniels boys. It's also worth noting that while my lie was harmless and uttered only to save myself, the one my middle brother, Mike, was about to spin was a lie told to save himself, but in so doing, damned another. And that, my friends, is the moral of this story. Your sibling is always so much worse than you. I hate to publicly shame him in this way, but trust me, we all must answer for our transgressions sooner or later. The hapless victim of my brother's most foul deed was none other than my poor, subdued granddad, who had diligently and impressively powered through his entire bowl of crapioca and was sitting back triumphantly, probably brimming with bacteria. Then he turned his head to possibly blow his nose. I don't know. Seems like grandpas are always blowing their nose. Maybe he was weeping into his napkin, throwing up, huffing glue, whatever his intention. This moment of distraction was his downfall. As soon as his attention was diverted, my brother, the heartless wastrel, picked up his untouched and very full bowl and proceeded to scrape its gelatinous contents into our granddad's bowl. Then the delinquent quickly set down his dish and looked up, as